Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of today's program, we'll be talking about Chechnya. In 1991, when the Soviet Union started to come apart, Chechnya declared its independence. Moscow considers Chechnya to be part of Russia and has never accepted the Chechen move to leave the Russian Federation. Fighting between Russian forces and Chechen separatists has continued in the years since. It's been estimated that in the last decade, over 200,000 people have been killed, and it doesn't seem that there's likely to be a solution anytime soon. At least Moscow has said that it will not talk with the rebels, and they show no signs of giving up. In this first hour of the show, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about the conflict, about its dimensions, about the background, and perhaps some things that the United States might do to help in a constructive sort of way. And our guest for the program is Robert Bruce Ware. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. And since 1996, he's been doing research in the North Caucasus. By his academic training, he is a philosopher, particularly interested in the writings of Hegel. And in addition to many articles he's written about Hegel and his philosophy, he's also contributed to the Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, Christian Science Monitor, the San Francisco Chronicle, and other publications. He's also taught at Oxford, at University of Buckingham, University of New Mexico, University of Texas, El Paso, Texas A&M University at Corpus Christi. He is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Ware, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I think perhaps while it's tempting here to, there would be enough if we just started with what happened in 1991. But I think to establish some kind of context, maybe first, you might talk a little bit about what has prior to 1991 and the declaration of independence by the Chechens, or at least some Chechens, what had been the historical relationship between Russia and Chechnya, and that is Imperial Russia, Soviet Russia, and then Russia after there was no more Soviet Union.
Okay, might be helpful to go back even just before, sometime before that, actually, very briefly. Because if we look at the North Caucasus, where Chechnya is located, what we can see really beginning, at least with the Arabs in the 7th century AD, is a series of invasions. The Arabs, the Mongols, Timur-Lane, Persians, and then the Russians came to this region and encountered very stiff resistance from the highland mountain peoples, including the Chechens, including many other ethno-linguistic groups in the region. So empires that have sought to conquer the Caucasus have run into the same problem over and over again, and that is that there's a freedom-loving people, many freedom-loving peoples in the Caucasus. It's divided up into small political, social units that resist conquest, and that you've got to conquer them one at a time. There's no one capital that you can conquer and get the whole region. And like mountain people everywhere, they're just used to putting up a good fight. So Russia arrived there in the 1700s and almost immediately started getting into trouble. There was a Caucasian war throughout much of the early to mid 1800s, let's see, it was 1831 to 1859, that was notable for its extreme brutality. It involved a union between the Chechens and the Dagestani peoples, who are to the east of the Chechens along the Caspian Sea, against the Russian Empire, and was just a horrific war that occurred for all of those years. Finally, the leadership surrendered. Of the Caucasian side, the leadership surrendered, and the region was absorbed into the Russian Empire with sporadic resistance now and again up into the Soviet period. The next really notable event that occurred was during the Second World War, the Chechens and some of the neighboring peoples, including, for example, the Ingush to the east of the Chechens, just to the west of the Chechens, were accused of collaborating, were accused by Stalin of collaborating with the Nazis. And as a consequence, the entire Chechen population, all men, women, and children, the entire Ingush population, some other North Caucasian groups, and some groups from the Crimea, were all loaded into cattle cars and deported to Kazakhstan or other destinations in Central Asia. The Chechens were deported February 23, 1944. There are estimates of perhaps one-third of the Chechen population dying en route. After that, they were barred from returning to their homeland until Khrushchev decreed that they could come back in 1957. They started filtering back after that time. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, just as you said, they were not particularly interested in remaining in the Russian Federation under the leadership of a radical, he was a Soviet general who had been stationed in Estonia, but he was an ethnic Chechen named Dzhokhar Dudayev, who came back for a national congress that was held in 1990 in Chechnya and started a program of a radical leadership that took Chechnya away from the Russian Federation progressively until the first war began almost exactly 10 years ago in December 1994. So actually your timing is very good here.
Well, so here we have a people with a history of being invaded, or at least large imperial powers trying to absorb them, with a very strong tradition of independence, a sense that they are their own people, and resisted very strongly being absorbed into these various empires. So 1991 comes, and there is this independence declaration. I guess one of the basic questions, and something that I know you have written about, and I think that it's an important question, is from that moment to this moment, how many of the Chechen people actually favor independence, and how many would be satisfied with greater autonomy within the Russian Federation?
Well, David, that's really the question, and there simply is no good answer to it, in part because the situation inside Chechnya is so difficult that there has been very little in the way of reliable survey research. There are some surveys that have been done of the population, but they've mostly been done by Russian organizations that raise some questions along with answering some questions. Let's put it that way. So probably the number has fluctuated. In 1993, the Chechen parliament sought to hold a referendum on exactly that question: should we remain, should we go with the Russian Federation, or should we go with independence? But Dzhokhar Dudayev, the radical leader whom I mentioned, refused to allow the referendum to go forward, brutally disbanded the Chechen parliament, had a bunch of thugs really go into one of their sessions and just throw some of the parliament, some of the representatives out of the window. After that, the Chechen Supreme Court, the highest court in Chechnya, declared Dzhokhar Dudayev's leadership defunct, but he ignored the high court and remained in power. Probably at that point, it would seem that around 50%, perhaps less than 50% of the Chechens would have supported independence. In other words, close to 50% probably would have wanted to remain in the Russian Federation, and probably that's why Dzhokhar Dudayev was afraid to let the referendum go forward. But then when Russia invaded Chechnya in 1994, there was inevitably a stiffening of resolve. People felt that groups within Chechnya that had been opposed to one another were suddenly united against Moscow as a consequence of the invasion, and fought hard against Moscow. So at that point, Chechen independence probably would have been more popular. And then certainly after they essentially defeated Moscow in August of 1996, Chechen independence would have been a popular cause. However, after that, in 1997 through 1999, the Chechen society degenerated. There was a failure to establish an authoritative government inside Chechnya. Even though a new president was elected in the winter of 1997, he was unable to assert his authority. And as a result, Chechnya came to be controlled by by a number of different criminal groups, essentially warlords with their own criminal organizations controlling small territories inside Chechnya and fighting among one another. And people in Chechnya became so disillusioned by the criminality and the problems that incurred during that period that when Russia returned to Chechnya at the end of 1999, there was considerable support for now once again rejoining the Russian Federation. However, then the Russian troops indulged in brutalities of many sorts that once again alienated more people. So we've got a situation in Chechnya now where most people simply want to be left alone and where most people are exhausted. They're seeking above all security, personal security, and like people everywhere else, looking for opportunities at least a minimum of prosperity. Mm. And most people in Chechnya, as far as I'm able to tell right now, would probably see the shortest path to those goals as being through membership in the Russian Federation. So not because of any great love for Moscow at this point, but more interest in joining Russia simply because it is the best way to get back to some kind of a normal life.
I should introduce again our guest for this hour. Robert Bruce Ware is associate professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. He is a philosopher by his academic training, who also studies the North Caucasus and has for a number of years. We're talking about Chechnya, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you have explained, the Chechen independence came in the fall of 1991, and it was not until almost the end of 1994, 10 years ago, that Russia, and at this time Boris Yeltsin was the president, Russia sent in troops. And there was this war, lasted almost 2 years. It's estimated that something like 100,000 people were killed, mostly civilians, and generally has been characterized as a humiliating defeat for the Russians. There was then the ceasefire and the peace treaty, and then their fighting again began a couple of years later. One of the things I'm curious about is why it is that it took so long for the government, for the Russian government, to make this decision that it was going to intervene military. It was going to send troops into Chechnya.
Again, that's an excellent question. It's a question that I asked myself a lot during the years from 1997 to 1999, when, as I say, there was really chaos inside Chechnya. And I was visiting the region regularly during that period and just saw the horrific toll that it was taking on the people around Chechnya, where there was a hostage industry that flourished inside Chechnya that involved the raiding into surrounding territories and the kidnapping of people that from the republics around Chechnya. And I should emphasize that this includes Muslim republics around Chechnya. The war is often portrayed as a Muslim society against Christian society, but when you get down there into the North Caucasus, you see that it's not that simple, that in fact the Muslim republics that are surrounding Chechnya were as much in need of support and as angry and upset about the situation in Chechnya as anybody else in Russia, in fact probably more so. And people were being taken back into Chechnya, held for exorbitant ransoms, and it gets pretty grim. There was an ongoing slave trade in Chechnya. People that weren't ransomed were sold into slavery. People were tortured on videotapes that were sent back to their families in order to extort exorbitant ransoms. And that's not even to mention the daily property crimes and plundering that resulted from gangs coming across the border from Chechnya. Inside Chechnya, things were even worse. It's estimated that as many as 10,000 Chechens were kidnapped by other Chechens during that period and held under conditions similar to those that I just described. So why didn't Russia go in? Well, I would say probably your characterization of humiliating defeat probably has a lot to do with it, that they were beaten in 96. They did feel weak. There had been a lack of popular support for the first war, in part because, just as you suggested in one of your questions, Boris Yeltsin probably went in too soon in 1994. He probably should have waited and built a better case or tried other means to see if he could work it out diplomatically with Dzhokhar Dudayev, but he went back in rather precipitously. They failed, lack of popular support, didn't feel that they would have much popular support to go back in after that, and really tried to stay out and just see if Chechnya would turn the course and move towards stability on its own. probably, at least from the standpoint of the well-being and the human rights of people in the region, they waited too long. But it took the invasion of Dagestan, that republic to the Russian republic to the east of Chechnya, in 1999. That is, Dagestan was invaded two times, once in August and once in September, by radical Islamist groups from inside of Chechnya. And it took that invasion to begin really publicly mobilizing the Russian people. And then there were a series of apartment block blasts that occurred, killing over 300 Russians, a series of terrorist acts, in fact, that further galvanized popular opinion toward restoring stability in the North Caucasus. Mm.
And here we, this was the time when, and I'm not sure at this time when either this Mr. Putin was campaigning or whether he had already been elected, but whether each of the, whether of those was the truth, it is true that he was elected on the strength of his reputation of being a tough guy, and that there was at least implied, if not right out, stated that he was going to go in there and he was going to take care of this problem, right?
Yes, David, you're exactly right. He, after the apartment block blasts, there were two blasts in Moscow on the 9th and 13th of September 1999, and after those blasts, President Putin made some very tough speeches in which he declared that he had seen a Chechen trace in the terrorist acts. And he used some very strong, almost vulgar language to assert that he was going to go in and straighten things out in the North Caucasus. And after that, he was prime minister at the time, by the way, not yet president. He'd been appointed prime minister by Boris Yeltsin at this point, but did prosecute the war very aggressively. And it was on the strength of his, not exactly just his aggressive prosecution of that war, but the can-do attitude that he conveyed to the Russian people after the very weak and vacillating years of Boris Yeltsin's regime. On the strength of that resolve, he was elected to the Russian presidency in March of 2000 and has taken a very strong position toward the situation in Chechnya and elsewhere in the North Caucasus ever since.
You mentioned the apartment bombings. There were two in Moscow, and there was one in another city, and they had been blamed on Chechen rebels. Interestingly enough, there always has been, and I'm not sure if this is still there, but for a long time there was this undercurrent of conspiracy thinking that said the people there apparently believed, some people at least, believed that the Chechens weren't responsible, that in fact the Russian government did this, and they did it to create a pretense for their going into in force, seriously going into Chechnya. And I know that you've written about that, and you believe that, in fact, the Chechens were not responsible, but you also believe the Russian government was not responsible.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I've looked into this quite a bit. I should tell your listeners very straightforwardly that there is a lot of speculation, just as you say, a lot of speculation along conspiracy lines, and not a lot of hard evidence about this. But there are some interesting information that has been largely overlooked by many researchers in this field, suggesting, first of all, that the Chechens were not responsible. In fact, there has never been any good information. There's never been any good evidence linking any Chechen leaders to the apartment block blasts that occurred in Moscow, or in the city to the south of Moscow called Volgodonsk, where there was a third blast on September the 16th, 1999. And there are reasons to suppose that some of the radical leaders in Chechnya who have been responsible for other terrorist acts, like, for example, the incident at the tragedy at the school in Beslan that occurred last September, some of those terrorist leaders in Chechnya don't seem likely suspects, in part because they have always claimed responsibility. In other words, even for the horror that occurred at that school in Beslan last September, one of the terrorist leaders in Chechnya stepped forward and said, "I'm responsible for that." And they've always done that. And yet none of them came forward and said, "I'm responsible for those apartment block blasts." Nor has Moscow ever produced evidence suggesting that any Chechen leaders were responsible. But at the same time, just as you say, there has been a lot of speculation that maybe Russian security services, essentially the successor organization to the Soviet KGB, now known as the FSB. There's been speculation that the FSB was involved in creating these terrorist acts as in an effort to mobilize the Russian people for a second war in Chechnya. In other words, that they blew up their own they blew up their own people in an effort to persuade the Russian people that they had to go back into a second war in Chechnya. And there is some evidence for this. It's quite interesting. That is, on September the 22nd, 1999, in a city to the south of Moscow called Ryazan, there was a resident of an apartment building who saw some men suspiciously carrying large sacks into the basement of his building. And he took it upon himself to investigate and found the sacks contained a white substance. He notified the police. They came and pulled the sacks out. There was no explosion, but there was some interesting evidence connecting the FSB to those sacks. And the FSB came forward a few days later after initially denying any connection and admitted that they had put the sacks in the basement and then said that it was all part of a training exercise, you know, rather implausibly. And certainly this is very disconcerting. I'm not sure that we should leap to the conclusion that the Russian security services are responsible for the explosions either. And one of the reasons that I have not done that has to do with some statements that were made by terrorist leaders inside of Chechnya around the time of the apartment block blast. Immediately after the first blast in Moscow, the leader of the radicals inside of Chechnya, his name is Shamil Basayev, said, quote, "The Dagestanis did it." The Dagestanis, of course, once again, are the republic just to the east of Chechnya. There had been a radical Islamist enclave inside of Dagestan, that is an Islamic extremist village, actually a group of villages right in the heart of Dagestan that has essentially seceded from Dagestan and seceded from Russia and had been involved in a series of violent incidents inside of Dagestan. In 1999, after Dagestan was invaded, the Russian military first pushed the invaders out of Dagestan and then eventually began shelling the Islamist villages inside of Dagestan. One of the people who had relatives inside of those villages was known as Emir al-Khattab. He was a Saudi national who had come to Chechnya in 1995 after having established connections with al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And he led a group of Arab fighters in Chechnya during the first war, then married a Dagestani woman from the Islamist villages that I mentioned inside of Dagestan. Now, Khattab was, along with Shamil Basayev, one of the major leaders of the invasions into Dagestan in 1999. When Russia started attacking the village where his wife's family lived, it appears to me that he then started blowing up these apartment blocks. Why? Well, actually, the first apartment block that blew up was not in Moscow. It was in Dagestan. It was in a Dagestani town very close to these radical villages I've been mentioning. It blew up on September the 4th, just a couple of days after the Russian attack on these villages began. And then the first, that was 5 days before the first apartment block blew up in Moscow. The next one was 4 days after that. The next one was 3 days after that one. That brings us to September the 16th, when the last apartment block blew up in Volgodonsk, south of Moscow. Four blasts, last one on September the 16th. Now, September the 16th was the same day that fighting ended in Dagestan. Emir al-Khattab said in an interview that we are going to be blowing up Russian cities. We're going to take the war to the Russian cities and kill their children just as they're killing ours, referring to the village where his own family was located. So on the basis of that timing, on the basis of the statements that were made, on the basis of the fact that whereas Chechen extremists typically declare their responsibility for terrorist attacks, whereas extremists in Dagestan and elsewhere in the North Caucasus typically do not claim responsibility for terrorist acts, it appears to me that at the very least we should accept as a primary hypothesis that the apartment blocks were blown up in retribution for the attacks on these Islamist villages in Dagestan, that the perpetrator, the chief perpetrator, was therefore likely Amir al-Hattab, who had his family in those villages, and that probably he was helped by a coalition or a loose organization of Islamist extremists throughout the North Caucasus. That Islamist extremism has come into the region. It's certainly been in Dagestan. It's in Chechnya. It's in Ingushetia. It's in all of the republics of the area. So probably we should say that the blasts were the work of extremists, not just in Chechnya, probably not even primarily from Chechnya, but from the whole region. And I should just mention then in concluding this that there was a credible conviction. There were credible convictions, in fact, of for the bombing in the Dagestani city, the first of the four blasts that occurred on September 4th. There were a series of credible convictions of Dagestanis from those villages who were captured, placed on trial in Dagestan, and the trial looked more or less legitimate to me. And one of the leaders of that group, one of the leading extremists that was convicted, said that he had formerly worked as a cook for Amir al-Hattab and Shamil Basayev inside in a Chechen militant training camp, and he at one point confessed to having brought the explosives to Dagestan to blow up the building beneath a truckload of watermelons. However, he did, I should say, add that he later recanted that testimony and claimed that it had been extracted under duress.
We are just a bit past the midpoint. I have a caller we'll get right to. I'd just like to introduce again our guest, Robert Bruce Ware. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville and is a philosopher by his academic training and certainly has written particularly about Hegel. He's also written a lot and done a lot of speaking, however, on the North Caucasus. He has contributed articles to newspapers in this country, the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, Christian Science Monitor, others, also some Russian papers, Pravda, the Moscow Times, and has spoken at many meetings and seminars around the world on this very subject. Questions are welcome. We're talking about Chechnya, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here on a cell phone calling here from our local area, Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Yes, I'm tuning in late, so if you've already addressed this, I apologize, but I understand that around 2000 or so, Chechnya filed an action for genocide in the World Court against Russia, and I was just wondering if you knew anything about that, and if you did, if you could say anything about the ultimate resolution of that proceeding, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the question.
Well, it's a particularly good question in that the gentleman who was a driving force behind that, a professor Francis Boyle, is actually a professor at an Illinois law school. In fact,
it's right here.
He's right there.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, good. I couldn't quite remember which law school it was, but good. Yes, he was one of the driving forces behind legal action on behalf of Chechnya, that and some other action that he was taking around that time and during the years immediately following. I did follow that for a while, and it kind of dropped off the radar screen. I certainly don't think that there was any conclusive or there was any conclusive decision by the World Court or any decision for that matter that was particularly favorable to the Chechen people, but I want to emphasize that I lost track of that one and am not sure actually how that was concluded. So I would be very interested in hearing more about that. But if I could just add my own perspective on that question, I think that Professor Boyle probably deserves a great deal of credit for becoming involved in this to the extent that he did, and I believe at one point he actually held a sort of an ex officio or a semi-formal appointment from the what might be described as the former Chechen government or the Chechen government in exile, depending on how you feel about it. I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, and while I think that clearly there has been, to say the very least, an unacceptable level of brutality in Chechnya, and that does deserve international attention, and it's very good that people like Professor Boyle have gotten involved in that. I'd have to say on this particular question, I was never convinced that the situation qualifies in any helpful way as genocide, and that is because in Dagestan, again, the republic just to the east of Chechnya, there are 100,000 Chechens living. They're indigenous to that part of Dagestan. They're known as Chechenikins locally. And the Chechenikins have lived peacefully inside of Dagestan, 100,000 of them. That's now over one-tenth of the Chechen population, unmolested by Russian troops or any other military or security forces that are around them all the time. So I certainly think that if Russia were trying to commit genocide, that those Chechens living just across the border from Chechnya would not have been left in peace as they have been left in peace. But I think that furthermore, on the other side, one thing that Professor Boyle and others who are interested in topics like this might want to take a look at is that when those invasions of Dagestan occurred in the late summer of 1999, they attacked mountain villages in Dagestan that contained 100% of the territory of small ethnic groups inside of Dagestan. For example, there's the Andi people, the number about 30,000 in total, and live in three small villages up in the Dagestani mountains. Well, all three of those villages came under attack during the invasions from Chechnya in 1999. So if we want to talk about a situation in which the entire ethnic territory of a group has come under assault, we shouldn't talk about Chechnya because that has not occurred. We should talk about what happened in Dagestan when it was invaded from Chechnya in 1999. And I don't say that in any way to suggest that Professor Boyle's efforts have to draw attention to the brutality and excess that has occurred in Chechnya have not been worthy. I just want to point out that the situation, in fact, is a little bit broader and more complex than I've seen indicated in any case in what I have seen of Professor Boyle's efforts.
Well, we have some other callers here. Let's continue. Next caller in line is Champagne, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Dr. Ware and I have actually disagreed on this point since my early classes with him at Edwardsville, but I will raise it again and hope he will humor me with a response. To my mind, I guess the all these factors that you mentioned in terms of Russians' intervention into Chechnya are important, but to my mind, the sort of factor of primary importance here is, you know, Chechnya's importance vis-a-vis Russia's oil market in terms of both oil fields and pipelines, which, you know, account for close to 50% of the country's exports. So I hope you would comment on that, and I'll take my response off the air.
All right.
Well, yes, I think this is my former student, Christian, and I'm as always, very glad to hear from him, and I've been very pleased to say that he's stayed with his interests in Russia. Yeah, that's a good question, and we should get to it at one point or another. Yes, Chechnya had important oil fields that were heavily exploited during the Soviet period, and Chechnya still possesses oil deposits that will be significant eventually for the redevelopment of the Chechen economy. However, those oil fields were so extensively exploited during the Soviet period that they aren't very important. They wouldn't make much of a difference, even if the Chechen oil industry gets up and running. They wouldn't make a very big difference at this point in Russian oil exports. Oil is very important, as the caller points out, to Russia's current economic situation. But Chechnya won't make much difference in that to the Russian Federation. What it will make a difference for is the people of Chechnya, so that when things eventually get sorted out in Chechnya and that oil industry kicks back in, well, it could mean revenues for Chechnya, depending on how these are sorted out by the Russian Federation or anybody else involved, by as much as $1.2 billion. Per year, and that would certainly be a big help to the people in the region. But I'm sure, as the caller knows, there's also an important pipeline that runs through this region and used to run right through Chechnya. It's a pipeline that was once entirely responsible for bringing the oil from Baku, Azerbaijan, one of the big Caspian Sea oil fields to the west, that is to us. The pipeline begins in Baku, and it runs to a Russian Black Sea port, and where Western tankers pick it up and bring it past Istanbul to us. And so this was very important. And during the years of Chechnya's independence, the pipeline was regularly raided. In other words, people were just tapping into the pipeline and stealing the oil, basically, that was flowing through from Baku. And so the pipeline had to be closed down. The Russian Federation built a new link to the pipeline that runs up through Dagestan and right around Chechnya. It doesn't go through Chechnya anymore. So there are huge oil deposits in this region along the Caspian Sea. Chechnya actually is not on the Caspian Sea, separated by about 50 miles of Dagestan that's in between. But still, Chechnya's stability is absolutely key to Western interests that are involved in extracting that oil and bringing it from the Caspian Sea westward, that is, not through Chechnya anymore, but around Chechnya, now to the north and also to the south, where there are currently three pipelines in existence bringing this oil out. So stability there is absolutely crucial. But I have to, the question's important, and it raises an important facet to it. I have to very respectfully reject the caller's implication that this war is all about oil, because the reserves in Chechnya just are not big enough relative to their significance within the overall Russian oil industry, which, as the caller indicated, is absolutely huge.
All right. And again, we have another caller here. The next is back here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had read that Shamil Basayev had claimed responsibility for the massacre at Beslan, but I'd also read, in fact, this morning on the BBC website that they think these people may have actually come from outside of the area, outside of Georgia or the Northern Caucasus. And I was wondering if you had any ideas as to who was actually behind that massacre.
Well, I don't have any information or insight into that other than what's been published either in the Western press or in the Russian press. Initially, there were claims by the Russian forces on the scene right as soon as the school was raided that there were two Arab bodies that they had found. But then they subsequently, Russian forces denied that they were Arabs, that because of the fire that ensued, some of the bodies were in very bad shape, and evidently they became clear later on that these weren't Arabs. But they were people that clearly did come from various points within the North Caucasus, including Chechnya, Ingushetia, and other parts of the North Caucasus, as well as a couple of Russians that were Slavs that were involved in the on the terrorist side. However, what the caller may be referring to is that, because I haven't seen the particular website he referred to this morning, is that there have been a series of claims that the 32 or 33 terrorists that were killed, one captured after the Beslan tragedy, were not all of those involved, and that there were other terrorists, maybe as many as 47 terrorists involved, that the Russian forces may have captured more than they've acknowledged, that they may be interrogating some of those who were captured, and therefore have wanted to keep all of this secret. But once again, this is, you know, there's a lot of speculation behind claims like this, and inevitably, in the North Caucasus, everybody's got a conspiracy theory. So I think we have to take claims like that with a great deal of thought, of salt, and wait until we see some kind of evidence. Of course, that's not what the caller was specifically alluding to. But
well, I mean, nobody really knows, I guess. I mean, they have.
Well, I think what I usually try to do is just to the extent that I'm able, you know, stick with the evidence. And what there is does seem to be credible evidence for is 33 terrorists, one captured, 32 killed, and that's about all we have that we can refer to with any certainty. So until I get more evidence, that's what I'm going to hold to.
Okay. Do I have time for one more question?
Sure.
Okay. You had written an article in the San Francisco Chronicle some ideas as to how people in the Northern Caucasus could be assisted you know, small business development projects, maybe developing some kind of Highland fruit industry. I would just say from what I've read about the area, it seems to be a very beautiful area. Do you think if things ever settle down there that tourism could become a moneymaker for people there?
Yeah, it is a beautiful area. The Caspian Sea is warm water, nice beaches. They've got this beautiful mountain scenery, snow-capped mountains most of the year round, and it's just a gorgeous place with a pretty nice climate and a local wine industry. And on top of all of that, this is where the world's best caviar comes from. So it's not a bad area to visit outside of the trouble. And it was a tourist destination in the Soviet Union. In fact, actually, throughout Russia's contact with the region, there were spas in the North Caucasus that was very popular to visit. So in some respects, tourism in the North Caucasus goes back at least to the 19th century. But what I've been arguing is that during the Cold War, the United States never hesitated, as a consequence of its ideological struggle with the Soviet Union, never hesitated to go anywhere in the world, regardless of how unsavory the local government was, in order to offer economic assistance intended to counteract Soviet ideal or communist ideological influence. And I've been arguing that, you know, we ought to be doing the same thing right now in the North Caucasus. That is because we are currently involved in a new ideological struggle with radical Islam, that radical Islam thus far is the only external force operating in the North Caucasus. In other words, the West is really giving the radical Islamists no run for their money there. Clearly, one of the things that's contributing to instability and terrorism in the region is the desperate economic straits that the local people find themselves in, with very high unemployment and very little opportunity for any kind of economic development. So I've been arguing that the United States needs to go in very carefully, and it would have to be very carefully, with a microloan program and other small business assistance, that we need to offer some money to build healthcare clinics there, that we should start training programs in which we bring people from this region to the United States, medical people, journalists, people involved in law enforcement and government, and partnering them with groups and individuals here who could help provide training, partnership programs between institutions, universities, newspapers, government organizations, law enforcement organizations, where people exchange information and support across the distance. Just as you suggested, I've argued that the one simple thing, if we just did one simple thing to help people in this region, we would try to put up some money to build Highland fruit processing plants, because they grow, you know, there's nothing but subsistence farming up in these mountain villages, but they grow really good fruits and vegetables, and then there's no market for them. So they, you know, they preserve them themselves and consume them over the winter or give them away to friends and family. But I've said, you know, if we could just set up some fruit processing plants up in the mountains to process the fruits of their gardens, that then we could, that would not only contribute to local employment, but would actually facilitate, I think, further agricultural production, since there would then be a market for it. All of this would get those mountain village economies going, and I think that would do a great deal to undermine alienation and radicalism that lead to extremism and terrorism in those villages. And if I could just add one more point, I would say that the United States should go to the Putin administration and say, we would just like to help, and, you know, we've got a little bit of money. It wouldn't take much money to help this region. It's not a large region, and it's a very poor region. And we'll do anything. Like, for example, after the Beslan tragedy, after the school tragedy in September, I think one thing that the Bush administration might say is, you know, we would just like to see teachers' salaries raised. And whatever the Russian Federation can do to raise the salaries of teachers in the North Caucasus, because they make $100 a month when they're paid, which is not often, whatever the Russian Federation does to raise their salaries, we'll double it. So, you know, you put in, $500,000 into raising salaries in that region, and we'll put in another half a million to raise salaries for teachers in that region. I think a gesture like that would not only help to stimulate the local economy, but would do a good deal to reverse a certain amount of anti-Americanism and anti-Westernism that has been creeping into the region. Hmm.
Just quickly, it seems that though that there would be it would be difficult for the United States to convince Mr. Putin that the Russian government should take a different tack there, because it seems that mostly their tendency has been to try to use overwhelming military force, or to the extent that they had that kind of force, to crush any separatist intentions, and then to also make sure that the government that exists is led by someone that's their guy. And also, they have put some money in, although it seems that a lot of that has ended up lining the pockets of the people who had the opportunity to take advantage of it. It seemed like it would be difficult for the United States to persuade the Putin government to do anything different, particularly because since September 11th, I think Mr. Putin has made the argument to the United States, he said, well, you have your terrorists and I have mine, and don't tell me how I need to deal with mine.
You're right on all of those counts. Clearly, the Russian Federation has never understood the North Caucasus and is not interested in understanding the North Caucasus. That certainly goes for the Putin administration, and you're also right that there are very high levels of corruption that would interfere with and are interfering with any efforts to improve the economies of these localities. Nevertheless, I would think that if the United States wants to begin nudging the Putin administration toward a different approach in the North Caucasus, then clearly the way to do that is not by bashing the Putin administration, which is what we tried pretty much from 1999 up until September 11th, 2001, not bashing the Putin administration, but simply saying, you know, there's a better way to do this, and we would like to get involved in a better way to do this. And I think if nothing else, David, because you're absolutely right, I think, in your realistic cautions about all this, but if nothing else, I think it would change the subject. In other words, once the United States begins talking about how do we just help out these villages, one village at a time, I would hope that if nothing else, the Putin administration might occasionally start thinking in those terms. And when they start thinking in those terms, we'll see things get better in this part of the world.
On to another caller here. I believe we have someone line number two. I think this is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, hello. This is Professor Francis Boyle. A friend of mine had told me you had mentioned the lawsuit that I filed at the World Court on behalf of the Chechen government, and we're wondering what has happened on that. I want to make it clear, I am the attorney of record for the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria by appointment of His Excellency President Aslan Maskhadov, the democratically elected president of the Chechen people. During the past decade, the Russian regime has exterminated approximately 200,000 Chechens out of a population of 1 million people, and that is their figures, not ours. This genocide is not yet at the level of the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, but it is getting there very quickly. The Russians have had a long history of ordering or perpetrating genocide against the Chechens, going back to Stalin, the NKVD, and the deportation, and even the Iron Tsar Nicholas I, who issued the infamous order to just exterminate all the brutes. The lawsuit I have filed, the World Court has met three different times on my application. They have made it clear to me that so far the burden is upon me to establish that we are an independent nation state entitled to file a lawsuit under the statute of the court, despite the fact that President Yeltsin did indeed recognize our independence. And then Putin, in order to get elected, just threw it by the wayside. By the way, the communist regime did the exact same thing to the Chechens after they had been originally established. They negotiated a peace treaty, and then when they thought they were strong enough, violated it. They did the same thing to Georgia. It's a standard operating procedure. As for peace negotiations, President Maskhadov has adopted a pretty comprehensive program to negotiate a provisional independence for Chechnya, subject to the control of the United Nations Security Council. Putin so far refuses to negotiate anything. Remember, Putin is a KGB agent, once KGB, always KGB. He has a KGB mentality. The KGB predecessor, NKVD, tried to exterminate the Chechens. So it does not look very good at all. I'm afraid the Chechens really have no alternative but to continue to defend their women, their children, their towns, their villages from Russian extermination. I do think the Bush administration has been helpful so far, and I would certainly hope that under the current situations of outright genocide perpetrated against the Chechens, that people listening here would encourage the Bush administration to reengage and to get President Putin to negotiate in good faith with the Chechen government. I am authorized to negotiate on their behalf. The Russians know it. They have my phone number. So far, they haven't bothered to call me or anyone else.
We're, I appreciate, Professor Boyle, you calling in and giving us the update. We're simply, however, going to have to stop at this point because we are out of time. We've used the time allotted for this first hour of the show. And I think that probably we've covered the ground pretty well, at least. And I want to say to Professor Ware, thank you for very much for being with us this morning and giving us some of your time.
Okay, thank you.
Our guest, Robert Bruce Ware, he is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, and for a number of years now has been studying the North Caucasus.